Welcome to The Color Cast, a show about color grading, color science, and post-production. We are the Coloristos. My name is Jason Myers. I'm a colorist and post-production engineer in Los Angeles.
And I'm Josh Petock, a colorist also in Los Angeles.
And I'm Juan Salvo, a colorist in New York City. And we're actually live and in person, all three of us in the same room here in Las Vegas. We're at NAB. And we're going to have a show for you about, it's going to be a quick one, but we just want to talk to you about kind of our experiences at NAB and what we're seeing and what we're interested in, what we're finding compelling.
First podcast with all three of us in the room at the same time, so we could see each other's reactions and gauge what's going on.
And the over-talking doesn't have to be quite so awkward because we can actually hear each other at the same time. There isn't that delay.
So what did we see at NAB that we totally? What was your favorite thing of NAB, Jason?
Oh gosh, you're making me pick favorites.
And you can't pick Resolve 10.
But no, Resolve 10 was a big deal, that's for sure. My favorite thing of NAB, gosh, I would probably say that there's a couple that I like. So maybe I'll pick one or two. The first thing that really impressed me, I would say, is probably the new Sony OLEDs. I think mostly because I feel like there's a really good shot that that's what I'll be using in the future. They really have seemingly fixed the color cast issue in the BBM and PBM. I find that those are much, much better now, and I'd actually probably really enjoy having one. They also previewed their large OLEDs, and those just look really spectacular. There's a thought that those might be out sometime in the near future, probably a year or more, but coming. And then I'm a Scratch user, so what I'll do is I'll bring up Scratch has a version 8 preview, and they have a number of really interesting forward-thinking collaborative features. Scratch actually has some things now where they're allowing you to sync all of your project data up to the cloud and go and take, if you have multiple Scratch systems, either for DIT or even in a color bay, and sync all of the data between all of your machines. You do need to have copies of your media, assuming you wouldn't want to move gigabytes, but largely anything you've done on one Scratch. terabytes. Yeah, exactly. you can't push that through the cloud quite yet, I don't think. But the thought is that they have a very sort of mobile device like syncing paradigm that they've created that looks very, very helpful and like sort of an interesting new area. I haven't seen it in any other app. So
it's very cool.
What about you guys?
Well, if I couldn't pick that, then I would say one thing that was very impressive was a base light slate. I thought that was a pretty cool interface. You know, they're kind of owning the fact that it's a small unit. It's not like they're control panel that's supposed to take up the whole entire desk or the whole room, but it was really cool to see, especially because I found out that it is potentially going to work with Symphony as well. So that was a really interesting development, and I actually learned a lot about just the inner workings of Baselight. They had a really good demo there, so I like that a lot.
We got that demo together, Josh and I, and I actually had the most fun for me, I think, at this NAB was just kind of getting to see some things and getting to hang out with these guys and sort of having a little more in-depth time with some of the software. So my overview of NAB this year is that we didn't have as much hurrah as maybe we had last year in terms of a lot of new products and everybody introducing new products. You had relatively fewer kind of products per manufacturer, but a lot more maturity of products. So I think, certain manufacturers were saying, making the point that every product that they were announcing was shipping. You had some products that maybe weren't ready for market that were just got kind of pulled out or didn't get mentioned, like I think the red laser is a good example where.
Yeah, it's interesting omission from the red booth this year. And Juan actually kind of called that, and we walked in there and it was not available to be viewed in sort of its, 2013 version. So.
Yeah, I mean, even so we're hearing differing things. I mean, one thing that we're hearing is that, it wasn't at the red booth. They weren't showing it. Obviously, it's not ready for prime time. But we're waiting on hearing from anybody else out there that can give us any info on technically if this product is truly dead. Just because we didn't see it at NAB doesn't necessarily mean it's a dead product, but we're kind of hearing rumblings like, well, don't completely count it out.
And so. I could see if they can make it work, because like things like the Christie projector with laser that where they're having to like vibrate the screen and do these extraordinary things in order to make it functional, in a kind of industrial or professional environment, you could pull those things off. But in the market they were aiming for, which is like kind of the high-end home market where it's like, you know, people who could afford a $10,000 projector, that market is not going to spend another $15,000 on a vibrating screen so they can, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Right.
So, but you could still see it kind of play out. If they can solve those issues, you could still see it, I think, kind of play out as a more kind of consumer-aimed device, sort of like the Red Ray.
One thing that's interesting about the laser, it's a sort of a new concept that we're all looking at and hoping might deliver some benefits. But right now it feels a lot like sort of the military technology that you see that is so complex that it requires huge intervention by a computer. Like, for instance, when the first stealth fighter came out, when the V-22 Osprey came out, these were large changes from what had been sort of the norm in, say, aviation. And they were so complex to fly that they needed to sort of have a lot of computer intervention. The pilot would do joystick, but largely what was going on in the actual wings and the surfaces of the plane was much more complex and sophisticated, not actually doable by a human. So what you see in the laser projection area, especially with, say, a vibrating screen and things like this, is that they're really being creative about overcoming some inherent limitations. So they might be able to tackle them, but in the real world, those will be tough to implement. Yeah,
the important thing to remember is I think with the laser tech specifically, and we sort of get excited by it because it's lower cost and brighter and it sounds cool because it's freaking laser. But the reason they want to do this and the reason like Christie's doing it is because you can polarize laser light at the source. So it's better for 3D. You can get brighter images in 3D and you can get really, really bright. So it makes sense in a 3D-centric world. But I don't know if we're in a 3D-centric world anymore.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that was surprising is there was a lot of 4K on the show floor. Everybody had 4K this, 4K that. Maybe 4K isn't ready for prime time. In some sense, we can get to displays, and I have some interesting ideas on displays. But the 4K has taken over where 3D was. And you saw very little 3D on the show floor. I saw a little bit of 3D over at the GoPro. We caught some of that. You see a little bit of 3D kind of floating around.
Oh, yeah, we saw the glassesless 3D in the Dolby booth, which was interesting. But it made it feel – it wasn't like poke you in the eye 3D. It was more like I'm looking into a bubble 3D.
Yeah, that was really nice. So Dolby did sort of the centerpiece of their booth. You know, beyond the PRM monitor was they had a glasses-free 3D set that they are developing, I believe, with Philips. And the image was gorgeous. It was really nice looking. You know, gradients and things like that were really kind of exquisitely rendered. But when you were looking at the 3D, while you could tell it was different from, say, the PRM, what happened is it was sort of 3D that seemed to be in a fish tank, you know, kind of like Josh was saying, in a bubble. So it looks gorgeous.
And recessive 3D.
Yeah, recessive 3D. And, you know, I don't know if that set at this point has the capability to sort of, you know, I guess what would be the positive, you know, out into the screen.
Well, I think, in fact, last year, and this is another thing, if you go to the Sony booth, the Sony's got the amazing 4K OLED monitors. Right, they're ridiculous. Right. The new OLEDs, which are really, really stunning. And they have this cool swivel thing with the old OLED and the new OLED. And they're like, take a look at the axis.
Yeah.
So they really nailed that.
They
and good
totally
for them.
Nailed it.
And my recommendation prior to this was to say that the PVM's a great monitor, but it's really for op only because of the axis issue.
Yeah. Yeah.
But now it's like, well, yeah, you could use that 25-inch OLED in a client environment and you'd be okay.
If you've had hesitations, like, feel free to jump in. I would say that the flicker and the color cast is really gone, and you know, at what, it's $300 more than it was. It's not a huge price increase.
Yeah.
If you'd like a really high end, wonderful, you know, 25-inch display,
you can't even buy the old one anymore. You have to buy this one. They don't even sell the old one anymore.
But you wouldn't want to.
Wouldn't want to.
I mean, and by the way, I love the prior generation OLED screens. I think they're great screens. So. That's not to diss the screens, but...
Right. It looks really good, and they did kind of prove it. They had the older monitor below and the new... basically...
On the same... Swivel,
yeah, on the
on
same...
Same
axis.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so they're noted with an A at the end, right? The... what is it? The
no, they're ones. So there's 2540 and 2541.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. And so, yeah. So largely, I would say that if you've been looking at that display, that's a really nice one. And then the other thing is that Sony also showed some of their consumer displays and then their prototype commercial displays. And, you know, even if Sony was our only option, the future looks really, really good. No pun intended. It was really dazzling over there. It was tough to go from the Sony booth to a lot of other manufacturers' displays, even if they were in sort of isolated environments, and find them as nice an image.
So to backtrack a little bit, the 4K has sort of taken the place of 3D in terms of being the hot commodity at the show, but it seems much more to me like, and I think this is the theme for the show this year, is it's a much more substantial show. It seems like it's really sort of maturing, or matured products and more matured workflows, and it's like real get work done kind of stuff that is what you're seeing, as opposed to the kind of dream big, let's all do 3D thing that we saw last year.
Yeah.
And so you see a lot of 4K stuff, and 4K is the big theme of the show, but it's a very realistic kind of what you can actually do in 4K.
Yeah.
As opposed to let's all be ready for the 3D revolution, which we didn't really think was going to show up.
Yeah.
And so, and this goes back to the laser thing, the 3D, if you take the 3D aspect away from it, if we're not all living in a 3D is everything world, then the laser paradigm is now irrelevant.
It becomes less relevant, maybe.
Well, but then,
you know, there's still a hope for affordable, high-quality imaging, but the big benefits aren't there for what we're now doing.
Possibly. Well, we have as colorists, we have a major there's a major problem for us to use lasers in that light doesn't look consistent to all people, to everyone. Head. So as a color critical display,
right.
It's hard to imagine how they could overcome it with laser light.
Yeah.
If there was such a thing as like a
broad-based laser.
Broadband laser, yeah. So basically the key issue beyond even, you know, vibrating screens and things like that is just this idea that the red, green, and blue primaries that the laser creates are so narrow that the interpretation by different people of what is red, what is green, what is blue is slightly different, possibly, as they mix the colors.
Well, it's that some people are just more attuned to particular wavelengths than others. So as you're slipping away from that wavelength, the color perception changes.
Amplitude of that color changes
exactly, because it's like the color value is, and I'm doing this in person.
We're drawing,
so I can draw in the air, but you guys aren't seeing it. But you know, it's a spike for red, spike for green, spike for blue, and there's nothing to fill in the gap. Right. So it becomes it's a very high signature sort of color signature.
And in the audio world, they would refer to it as a high Q sort of a curve, which is the idea that the peak is much taller than the width. And so what that creates is this spiky response that can create a
difficulty. That varies.
That varies. Exactly. Yeah. That causes difficulty between, say, audience members.
Whereas like xenon light is a very, very, very broad light where it's just almost flat across spectrum, and in terms of the way we respond to it. And so to us, it seems like it's just a very consistent,
right? No matter who you are and how your eyes are perceiving,
pretty much see it the same because whatever wavelength your eyes respond to, it's filled in by that light, whereas with laser it isn't.
Let's do this real quick. So I'm sure a lot of people are interested in software, so like, for instance,
I was gonna say in the last podcast, we kind of had our wish list for what we're going to do for Resolve.
Okay.
And so we now know exactly what they released.
Yeah.
So
a hell of a lot more than I thought.
Yeah. What was our scorecard?
Oh, gosh. On it?
We'd have to review.
We have to review it.
Yeah. I mean, how about
We didn't say anything about live grading, which they offer now. Anything about plugins, which they are offering now.
I really thought that wasn't going to happen. I thought that was too difficult to pull off, and darn if they didn't do it. So, I find it remarkable that they're going there, because they're allowing now third-party products to possibly, you know, create a new thing for them to work through or overcome in terms of performance issues, but hopefully the standard will hold up.
There's something very kind of amazing that happened at this NAB. And it happened in a matter of hours, which is OFX went from being kind of fading and irrelevant
to
now it is going to be huge.
It's going to blow wide
so
open.
So I'm looking to see a lot of third parties just hop on that bandwagon really fast.
The funniest thing that I heard was I went into the Boris booth and I was like, oh, do you guys have an OFX plugin? And they were like, yeah, for Sony Vegas.
Oh, God.
And I was like, I guess it should work.
Yes, it should. It should work.
Yeah.
That's the thing is they're saying like they are supporting the OFX spec. It seems like they're demoing the Sapphire plugins. Yeah. And that's a great set of plugins right there.
Yeah.
What I'd love to see is the existing OFX mug, and their Neat Video has OFX, there's a few OFX plugins floating out there. And so there's some really, really good ones like the GenArch ones. I'd love to see, it's a huge market, so we'll probably see some pricing changes.
Right.
So it seems, if GenArch is selling for, I think it's...
Well, it's $16.99, I think, at least if I were to buy it for scratch.
Right.
Which supports OFX.
So it's the same licensing probably, but you'd look to see that kind of drop down.
Yeah.
So for Neat Video, if you... it's GPU enhanced as well. Mm-hmm. So if you use that inside of Resolve, do you get the same benefit? Or are you kind of splitting the
difference? Yes, but you're splitting the available GPU functionality.
Right.
So it's, you're going to lower your Resolve performance and you're going to have lower Neat Video performance because they're sharing the load. But we've got new GPUs coming out. We've got hopefully more kind of options in terms of how we integrate those GPUs, and then we'll see it. The OFX, I think the plugins in general, it's going to be a thing where you're going to put it in at the end of kind of after you've locked your picture,
right?
Because it's just not going to be, and I think the render cache is going to become a really important thing for people there, because you're really going to have to kind of render cache that out.
Yeah. And the example that I saw, essentially in the system that I was working with, they had dual 580s. They had a very calm, let's say, node graph. It was probably 3 or 4 nodes of primary correction, I think maybe a secondary for fun. And then they added in a Sapphire flare, and it went from 24 frames a second to 15 frames a second with one flare.
I'm surprised it's that high.
So it's going to be GPU. It's going to be a big deal.
Very taxing. And then, of course, there's things you can do to optimize, and we'll see what the... But I'm gonna look to see. I think I would hope Sapphire GenArch will kind of reevaluate the pricing on Sapphire, maybe drop it down. I'd love to see that for $1,000. I think they'll sell a lot of Gen units. And I think the OFX guys, you're gonna see a lot of guys hopping in the OFX bandwagon. But more importantly, it becomes, you have Resolve Lite out there as a free host. It's a free host for OpenFX now.
Well, is there a question as to whether it'll be supported?
It's in Resolve Lite.
Pretty much, so just like noise reduction, whatever that new, there's.
But
new
here's the thing: so noise reduction, Resolve's built-in noise reduction, not in the Lite version. Right. But you could buy Neat Video,
right?
That's
and
true.
You've got noise reduction.
How much is Neat Video?
I think the OFX is like $300.
But. Yeah. Well, and you know what? It might even be like $199. I'm trying to remember.
Okay. Well, something around that.
It's really affordable.
It's not $1,000 like Resolve.
Many, many noise reduction products are a lot of money.
The $1,000 in Resolve gives you a lot more than just noise reduction. But
then
you've got, now you've got temporal noise reduction, spatial noise reduction, and something that's really cool is you can add motion blur. So it's got motion estimated.
Add motion blur.
So you can, this will be really cool for if you've got stuff that was shot with a fast shutter and you want to kind of, or you've got things that you're speed adjusting, you may want to smooth them out. And you've got optical flow
retiming,
which is amazing.
My God. It looks gorgeous.
What about the optical flow? I'm assuming that's not going to play in real time. It's going to actually play to get an idea of what it is.
It is CUDA enabled. It's analyzing motion over time, but I think they're doing it on the CUDA thing. So I played with it on an iMac and it wasn't real time, but I would imagine you'd do a bit better with something like on a Cubix. I think it's going to depend on your config, but I wouldn't be surprised to see system configurations that could do real time HD optical flow.
Wow. Yeah.
But again, you'll be able to switch it. So you'll be able to do like frame blending and then switch to optical flow. So you edit with frame blending. Well, you're editing now. You can kind of do your grade with frame blending, switch to optical flow, maybe tweak it if you need to, and then render it out, and you're done. Right.
You know what the most remarkable thing about OFX support is? Is that Resolve is now a very decent online editor, and we haven't even gotten to that yet.
That was in the
so
banner.
The
right?
edit tab is now in Resolve, and you can essentially take the conform page and look at it as a real. An honest NLE. Not that you would do offline, but if you want to do any major changes as well as lots of transitions and various effects.
Just last week in my rush to kind of get things done, get things ready for NAB, I did a very simple edit and I just went right into Resolve. Normally I would have done it in, Avid or whatever and done a little assembly and then sent it out to Resolve. I was just like, I don't have time for this. I'm just going to...
That was your Lift Gamma Gain comment, wasn't it?
What's that?
You said, or you could just edit and resolve.
I did. I was doing it as I wrote that. Yeah. And it worked. I mean, it was fine, obviously.
That's awesome.
Yeah, easy to do. So even in 9, you can kind of edit. In 10, those things are improved. Yeah. And you have things like titling, and you have things, you know, compound clips you'll be able to do, mm-hmm. and some really cool stuff. So. Yeah. Big update.
So, still talking software updates. Actually, not that we want to give complete control to Blackmagic, but the software improvements that I saw in Base Light Editions was really actually pretty good. They hit the two things that I really was looking for in Editions, which were adding the scratch pad and adding the gallery, mm-hmm. which actually makes it pretty compelling to
and
use.
On the Slate now, they've told me that on the Slate, you'll be able to use the gallery
yeah.
and have thumbs in the on the Slate itself. Because right. the Slate is just like the Blackboard 2 is an LCD screen backed up. Set of buttons.
And the Slate is going to be about $12,000. I mean, it's a little bit pricier than most of the other panels, but not as expensive as a full
panel. It's almost like they listened to our panels podcast and then decided around that because they really hit that spot that we were kind of mentioning of you know, good quality balls, you know, some feedback in terms of getting, you have the displays on there, you have the display buttons and
soft
button
yeah.
functionality that's really versatile.
Right.
So you're really kind of getting a pretty killer panel in that. I would, you know, they mentioned that they're able to kind of use it, they might be able to make it work with Symphony. I'd love to see it work with a host of other applications.
It's a beautiful panel. I would say very few people who are interested in something like that would step up to it and reject it. It's really nicely designed. They say they have more coming for it. And the thing is, it makes a really nice compliment to their beautiful Baselite 1 desktop, which was sitting there sort of, you know, inconspicuously leering up at us. And, you know, I would say a lot of people who would love to have Baselite have a real shot right. at it. It's gorgeous. It's basically a super micro chassis. It runs a full version of Baselite. Essentially, the thing that's really amazing to me when I was learning about it was they said it can actually do 2K and 4K resolutions, but you do have to be careful up around 4K where you can run into some processing issues. And a big question people had was that it does have a 2 terabyte SSD cache, but FilmLight, all the guys said that you can add up to 2 different I/O cards in additional slots that are open. Most of the popular I/O cards, like an R680 from Atto or say a fiber card from LSI or Atto, are supported in Red Hat Linux, which is what it runs on. And so you can add your own storage. So if you have a nice SAS RAID array yeah, or if you have a fiber
Jason
array.
Jason beat that to death at the booth.
Well, no.
I use my own storage?
But what I would say is here's the deal. That's the make or break situation. Classically with a lot of the heavy iron
well,
systems.
Well, before they wouldn't even sell it. Right. You had, to, buy
you had to buy their storage. Drives used to be a major profit center for Avid. Yeah.
Right.
Remember that?
Well, not only them, but like Autodesk, they were like you had to buy stones, right?
So here's the deal. I mean, if I
those stones are so freaking heavy. Did you ever listen to them?
That's why they called it a stone.
The stone ring? Like it was like 300 pounds. It was right. You had to take the drives out in order to lift it. You still need 2 people to lift it.
Yeah. Well, how about this? If you happen to have a stone array lying around, you can use it with your base light.
Excellent doorstop.
What would those get? About like 75-80 megs over like SD young compressor.
I never owned one. I didn't have the 100,000 for it back when they were available.
But, did they used to call it wired and stone?
Well, what it is stone was the actual array, and you had this is Autodesk terminology.
It was discrete.
Well, yeah. Yeah, discrete times. But basically, stone is the array, and then what you would connect often between other Autodesk products was wiretap.
Yeah.
And then they invented wiretap gateway, which was this ability to, say, read R3Ds and
anything.
Yeah. And so the thing is, though, is that just back to Baselite, because I think this is really clutch. If you're a person that's really been interested in Baselite, and I'm thinking of you, Hillary, so if you're listening, basically the deal is that you have an option now that is a legitimate, fully featured Baselite. I believe the starting price is $45,000, and then they're going to have a deal where if you want to buy the Baselite desk side as well as the Slate, I think that's going to be around $55,000, $56,000. If you can make a business case for that with, you know, the work that you do, I would say this is a really nice time to be a colorist because you can go and take a previous investment and say some sort of storage that you have, add it to this Baselite 1, and you can be a Baselite colorist as an owner-operator or maybe a small work group. And I think that's a really big deal. And the fact that Baselite is attempting to make those options available is really progressive to me, considering the expense still of many of the other larger heavy iron competitors out there. So
right. Even look at Paul. He Provost.
Yeah.
He built that RAID array that he just had for like $1,500.
And he could go and put that investment right toward a Baselite 1 and it would work.
Yeah.
And
well, that's you have to reformat everything.
Well, of course, yeah. But no, actually,
they said it works in HFS Plus.
They said that you can.
You don't want to work in HFS Plus.
Right. Yeah. But the thought is that it's at least flexible enough that you could try. But the deal is that, yeah, you'd probably format it, XFS or something like that or whatever they specify, EXT3 or 4.
Actually, Baselite uses their own, so they have a clustered file system. Okay. It's their own file system.
Oh, right. That's right. Because he said
and it's probably optimized for media and things like that.
Yeah, and for distributed processing, right, which is what they do on the Baselite 2.4.6, 2.4.8. Yeah.
And then just to finalize the FilmLite adventure we had today. So another thing, FilmLite has a really wonderful media manager now. So if you are in a situation,
I wouldn't call it media manager. No, I would call it an asset manager.
Asset manager, yeah. System, so yeah. MAM asset. And so the long story short is
media that, manager to me is like what comes with FCP.
Yeah,
7.
Exactly. Okay, an asset manager.
They can do that already. Yeah. They got all kinds of outputs.
Well, what's really remarkable about it is it's an application that runs on either Linux, like say your Baselite, or it runs on OS X. Believe it or not, which they found was a popular option for assist stations. So they made that for the clients. I think the Linux connection.
Well, it allows
you to search for your media with like literally this interesting nodal workflow. So
it's a great, great management tool, and there isn't a really clear answer like for post in general. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of like sort of one off answers for asset management, and when you're dealing with if you're like a one man shop where this is an issue, mm-hmm, but when you're dealing with multiple stations or something with a large shop, you know, you have Josh has got, you know, you have Interplay you guys use, right?
No,
you
don't use no way, we don't touch.
So what do you use for how do you do asset management then?
Josh's powers.
No, we don't. Well, I don't, but a lot of the assists they have within Media Composer, you can do the same thing pretty much.
So you're doing manual asset management within a Media Composer.
Yeah, well, we do it with ISIS. What ends up happening is you can make workspaces for each individual project.
And then you move stuff from workspace
and then
to workspace.
You go, okay, we know that this project is done. We can do it. And so it's just like it.
Do you ever lose a shop because a project was taken offline? And it was actually referred to another
project. I mean, not usually. I mean, they take a long time before a project is actually archived. We archive everything to LTO tape at the very end. And so it's all in how it's set up. We have very rigid guidelines for everything is set up, and so we know exactly when to delete everything.
I will say this. I think that Baselite kind of stepping in and kind of trying to manage that and offer some solutions that are meant to work directly with them and also integrate with third parties.
Right.
Is a great idea. They already had kind of some of that functionality built in. Like they were already doing metadata and doing that kind of tracking stuff, and they could already sort of associate things with projects. Mm-hmm. But just putting a front end on it, mm-hmm, and making it a nice kind of really cool, search tool and making it really neat, is a nice thing. And it's cool. And they've got a great sort of series of steps now. They've got the 995 plugin. They've got the
Baselite 1
and
the slate
and the slate, and they've got the Baselite 2, Baselite 4, Baselite 8, mm-hmm, and they're covering all their bases there.
Yeah, it's really exciting, mostly just because they seem to get it. They're trying very hard, and the stuff that they're doing is not trivial. I mean, they're not just sort of trying to put a product out there that isn't thought out. It's all really heavily thought out, and they're showing that they care about, you know, smaller individual users and larger pipelines equally.
I do think that, we haven't gotten a chance to get in depth into it, but I will say there was a lot of traffic at the Mystica booth. It seemed like the SGL booth was really popular. So it seems like we've kind of seen the market that was like kind of really saturated and sort of dispersed, kind of narrow and coalesce a little bit.
Yeah.
I think you're seeing some kind of some products sort of become less prominent.
Right.
Yeah. And
speaking of less prominent products, last podcast we talked about this is make or break for Avid.
Right.
Yes. I don't know if that's a fair segue
into
at a basic level.
Speaking of people who are completely effed. Yeah.
Well, no, but I'll tell you, the Avid people were out, and it was a it was a very exciting Avid booth. There was a lot of people there. We saw some cool people. We saw Terry Curran.
Yep.
And it was so funny. I have some pictures I'll post of Josh just working the hell out of a demo artist. And it's sitting there. It's like almost like there was this like ring of space that separated around Josh as he was just grilling this guy. And it was really cool. The guy come up and like was high-fiving afterward. But because, you know, I'm sure he was tired of answering all sorts of like, well, how do you import media questions? And Josh was actually getting to cool stuff. But it was amazing because there was a big, big crowd around every demo booth at the Avid booth. Yeah. And I was stoked for them because, you know, frankly, we do need them, I think. And I would like to see them be successful.
Symphony went from a application to just an add-on.
Yeah, an add-on. So how does
Which
that work?
It always has been. Like,
it pretty much has been.
It's been that way for like 5 years. Right. Like, yeah. This is the same hardware.
Right.
It's the same, code base.
So break it down. What's the pricing structure now if you want to buy?
It's $9.95 for the Media Composer.
Right.
And then it's like $14.95 for the add-on?
Yes.
For the add-on.
For the add-on. Which gives you that Boris
we'll
Continuum.
We'll throw you in.
Yeah, we'll throw it in. Which gives you the Boris Continuum, which is $19.95.
Yeah.
So it's actually pretty good value, except when you consider that a year ago, they were fire sailing Symphony for $9.95. But it's nice to see that sort of, we knew that they were going to have to clean up their sort of product offerings a little bit because it just didn't make a lot of sense. They didn't have that much differentiation between Symphony and Media Composer. And it's nice to see them kind of recognize that and change it accordingly. What's not so great is there's no real development in the Symphony stuff.
Right.
Not
so it's just basically you're paying $14.95 for last year's tech.
And you know what? There were guys there talking about it. You know, a number of people, we'll leave them unnamed, were kind of a famous quote was, Media Composer or Symphony 6.8.
Yes.
And so, you know, there was this hope for color tools, right, you guys?
Yeah.
And so it didn't show up.
No.
Yeah.
I mean, really what Avid is living on is that relational color corrector. That's really the only major thing that separates them from anything else.
And it's so valuable that even in the face of no color developments, people won't give it up. So that's remarkable.
Yeah.
Well, you're also dealing with like the Avid customers are not just, you know, individuals and sort of small shops. They're large sort of enterprises that have to have very sort of standardized workflows for things. Mm-hmm. And so they just kind of stick with what works until it doesn't work anymore. Right. And so we're reaching the thing that I think the 4K and or HD plus resolutions is going to be kind of that tipping point, right? If they don't.
Right. And they're still just supporting HD resolutions, although they have a nice,
they have a little PanaScan thing or whatever.
Yeah, FrameFlex, they're calling it.
Right.
Which is the ability to choose from a 4K frame what you would like to play in your HD window.
Yes.
Okay, right.
But, you know, is that enough?
Josh, is it enough?
For offline editorial, it's definitely enough. But and for
look, none of my stuff's going to get shot 4K anytime soon.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. You might have like
Blackmagic Cinema camera?
350 will be a 4K MPEG-2 F420 8-bit record. And you'll be doing the next Mind Show on that
And it'll also be 5 stops underexposed.
With very 4K noise. Yes.
In terms of some of the other products, just, you know, to make sure we cover things like did any of you see SpeedGrade? Did you guys check out the Adobe booth?
To be honest, I didn't.
There's just
not enough time.
I think a little look at it. I mean, I think some of the things I'm seeing in Premiere are really cool.
People are really excited, it sounds like, about Premiere.
For me personally, there's a couple of missing pieces, and I don't know if they're going to get to it.
I give it a 95%. I would say last year was 80%.
I would say for most people, it's there.
Yeah.
You know?
but you still have to do the DPX workflow, right?
For Premiere itself, like the fact that they've built DNxHD into the app, was one of the big kind of missing pieces.
Yeah.
Was like a sort of built-in codec like every other NLE has. They're just like, well, you guys have a codec already. We'll just use that.
Yeah.
So they've built it into the app, and it's working properly in an MXF, Avid MXF. So you can use Avid MXF Media.
Oh, wow.
You can go into an Avid Media folder, and you will see the clip, and you will see it with the appropriate name, and you will see it with the appropriate audio channels.
Nice.
So it's pretty great. And then you can also pull an AAF out, and it works really well. the and it's displayed properly, which no other app other than Avid and Resolve I've seen display the NX HD properly. Mm-hmm. And it does, and it displays it properly both in an MXF container and in a Qt container. Mm-hmm. So it's no longer using the Qt engine for playing back that the NX HD. It's now using its own DNX HD decoder. So those are great things, because that means that makes DNX HD a little more valuable. The big problem with the NX HD was if you weren't going to Avid, you would have an issue with the Qt codec. So this means, like, if you have a client who's on a PC on Premiere, who doesn't have Avid, you can still deliver from Resolve. You can deliver that DNX HD codec, or you can work. You know, hopefully we'll get to the point where we're maybe moving away from the Mac because we're not so dependent on ProRes. You know, we're
having right. That, at least there's an option. So there's a thought that there's a good way to go. If it comes to pass that we have to change.
Exactly.
Yeah. Did you guys take a look at Smoke at all?
No, they don't did have you actually tell new. Them, like, where is Luster?
Yeah. Did you ask
did
for the
you
Luster?
Put the banner
did
you ask up? Luster? Where is Luster?
I, you know, essentially, how about this? I tried to be nice. I knew that they would just sort of roll their eyes. So what I did do, actually, is they were actually Matthew Murano, I Love Hugh,
yeah.
is was going around taking some sort of perspective reactions from people who were at the, you know, it's cool.
I wanted to see your reactions.
Yeah.
And here's our color tools.
And what I did, essentially, they asked me to do one, and I told them that I thought that the new Service Pack 2 is a lot better than some of the earlier pre-releases I used. I actually, believe it or not, edited our last podcast. I did the audio for it in Smoke, and it worked really well. Yeah, it was great.
Smoke, audio editing tool.
I know, but what it was is that Smoke does have nice audio editing features, and, you know, I was
Autodesk should just put, like, a little, you know, yeah, coloristos, right. Edited in Smoke.
It was a great exercise in Zoom and pan and scan in the timeline. I feel very capable now. You know, an hour-long podcast in Smoke, and it worked no problem.
With absolutely no video.
No video, yeah. The video just sat there, like, lonely and empty the entire duration. But
you should have just put something in just to, like...
I know.
And then done a 3D composite.
We call it
a
token video track. But the thing that was cool was that they were trying to get feedback. And so I put in a little, you know, blurb for them. And what I asked for was some sort of grade management. And I did. I asked for Luster-like tools. In the color warper or color corrector, you
very
know,
subtle.
Yeah,
very subtle. Nice.
You know, I tried to be reasonable in my request, but yeah, the thought is that I think that Smoke is doing well. I think the guys at Autodesk are trying really hard to move it forward, and there was a nice crowd there. The Autodesk booth wasn't quite as massive as it was last year, but it was a good booth. You could tell that they were doing a lot of things there. So I'm hopeful that, you know, they look at that feedback, and it's cool that they're even collecting it, you know? So yeah. That's nice. I mean, I guess in terms of what will happen over the next year, maybe IBC will see Smoke 2014 announced, and hopefully there'll be Luster something or other in there. You know, so we'll see.
Did you find it at the booth though? Did you look
in
for
terms
it?
Of Smoke?
Or, yeah, actually on display at the booth.
I was watching Brian Mulligan. He was doing they had probably about three or four Smoke stations, and then on the other side they had a lot of the animation tools, the 3D tools.
They didn't have a Flame station?
What they were doing Flame essentially in the Center Theater.
Okay.
And so the flame demos were in the Center Theater.
So that's
theater.
Where if you were to get a Luster demo, you would get it there.
Yeah. And I did watch a portion of it. I didn't see Luster peek its eyes out or anything like that. But what I'll say is that it's in there, and I don't think I'm the only one that thought it might be cool. I'm sure other... Actually, when I brought it up to the guys doing an interview, Matthew and his partner, I remember them saying that it was a popular request, that many people who they had interviewed, I think I was like fifth or sixth or something, everyone had mentioned that. So
it should be a no-brainer.
It like, should be. You know, there's a lot of no-brainers.
I mean,
there.
what I would like to see is, and I said this before, when 2013 was first announced, is I'd like to see them open up the project exchange so you could send things out. But I think, I mean, in addition to that, having a real kind of color management process and better grading tools would never hurt anyone.
Right.
But there's a lot of, you know, Media Composer has some basic coloring tools. Final Cut's got the 7-way. You know, Premiere's actually got decent coloring tools built in. So all of these NLEs are doing those things, and they're giving you the option of going out and doing stuff. Plus, you have third-party plugins that you can purchase and do stuff with in the NLE, like Baselite Editions.
Right.
So, you know, options are great, and I think I would love to see Smoke have a project export option, right. And I would love to. And I also like
not
to
see so it. Locked within the files, deep within USR/ you know, discrete.
Well, in the bowels of your Mac, just an XML export, whatever.
And there's a thought that they might be doing that, right? There was a discussion about whether or not they were going to support XML export.
So, which would be great.
Yeah, which would be
amazing. I mean, the current, like, the FCP 7 XML probably wouldn't work with the way they kind of handle media.
Right.
But you could, you know, you can modify it and just spit it out there and let people deal with it.
Yeah.
Be like, here's what we're doing. This is our XML.
Yeah.
Use it if you want it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you guys check out the Quantel booth at all?
I saw some cool stuff at the Quantel. So they're doing, like, they're doing 8K playback, actually.
Right, 8K playback.
Which is insane. Didn't
see that. Which was kind of like their big notable feature. And then they have a thing called SynthIA, I think.
I was demoing on Monday. I was demoing at the NVIDIA booth, and we were doing live 4K deep air, 4K playback on a 4K screen. Which is actually, we were using a relatively inexpensive monitor that the Sharp 50, 30 inch.
The IGZO or whatever, right?
Yeah, it's an IGZO panel, and it's like, it's going to be like $5,500. It's not a crazy expensive screen, but it's really a computer display.
30 inches?
It's 30 inches, but it's a computer display. It's not, and we were just using it just because we wanted to show the resolution. It wasn't really a color critical demonstration. We were just showing we're doing 4K deep air and in high quality on F55 footage,
which looked really nice
in real time.
Yeah, in real time.
But you know that panel is not really a color critical panel, but it's a really cool looking desktop. Like it would be awesome. And something like, you know, we were talking about Resolve 10 having all this, and Baselite too, you know, having these really kind of intricate UIs, you know, having that screen real estate is actually helpful.
Yeah. It helps open your vision up and be able to see the controls, like, let's say, without as much strain as maybe a small monitor.
A little bit worrying, I think, is a Resolve a control surface, and we'll see the control surface kind of, I think the mappings develop a little bit as 10 gets developed. But one thing that's sort of not troubling, but just one kind of got you for control surface owners is that a lot of the really cool new stuff in Resolve, like the splitter combiner nodes, are going to require like mouse interaction, and it means we're going to have to get off the panel to use it. But it's so cool, it's worth it.
It's totally worth it.
Well, we did see those X keys too.
Yeah, that's
pretty
neat.
Gives you some ideas. It's a little like booth that was out in the middle of, you know, the corner of South Hall or something like that. But it's this little USB panel, and it's got like 24 keys on it that you can program in to be any keystrokes that you want.
It's a little USB pad.
Yeah.
And it's with keyboard keys? Or
no, like they're like keycaps.
Like tangent type.
No, it's more like buttons, like keyboard buttons, but in a square. It's kind of like almost like a Lego kind of a look to it.
Yeah. Mm.
It's like blocks. Mm. And you can put your own little stickers in the keycaps for whatever you want to map to it.
Right.
And you can, it comes with a controlling application that lets you associate that with a command shortcut or whatever.
And so it's pretty sophisticated, right, Josh?
Oh, Controller Mate, I think, is. It's like a whole, like, nodal, like, programming thing. And you can say if this happens and if, you know, click your mouse here, it's got a lot of functionality to it. I like
even
it a lot.
You could see something,
see something like that being as a sort of complement to another panel. So, like, for example, you could use it as, like, direct access to memories. So you could have like your memory A, B, C, D, you know, whatever mapped out on it. Right. And then for $120, you can get 16 keys.
24.
24 keys. So you can map out like almost all your memories. And then so you could have your memories in front of your, let's say, elements. And you're grading away and you hit memory A. Or you can hold down the option key and hit memory A and save the memory and work that way.
But remember, for us non-Linux users, we only get up to H.
So, is that right?
That's right.
You don't get all the way through Z?
Nope. We only get up to H.
On the panels, I get through C on the Mac.
I know you do on the panels, but we only get until H.
I'm sorry, Josh. Well, you can use the other keys for other stuff. You could disable on, off, and next node, previous node. Next
I think up to H in memory should probably be enough for me, honestly, though.
But I think Z is not enough for me. I want, like, you know, AA, L through ZZ.
Because usually, like, by the time I get to another scene, I'm already kind of clearing some of those. Anyway.
Yeah, I mean, if I organize my memories, yes, they would be enough. But that would require organizing my memories, which is a hassle.
Yeah.
Any other products we're trying to think of? Like, I guess you were mentioning Mystica earlier. I guess they introduced their new color tools.
Yeah, and they have, I mean, they had a really busy booth, and they're showing some, they're getting some really cool, you know, their big thing is, I think the reason they're kind of filling that space that Pablo is maybe falling behind in. And it's really just because they're getting really good performance out of their boxes. And so they're able to, and they have those 3D tools, and they have the HFR tools, and they have a nice conform tool as well.
Yeah. And plus the DCP mastering and.
Well, now Resolve has DCP mastering.
But what I'll say is that that's kind of, you know, good on Resolve, because that's a really progressive feature that a number of products don't have. You know, that there's a lot of
hubbub. Yeah, I mean, you're seeing JPEG 2000 encoding being a standard. Right. I think it's open source. It's not like you have to purchase and they have non-open source codecs in there. So, but you know, you know, just having that out there, and what the real advantage is, it lets you skip a step, so you don't need to necessarily make that really huge DCDM master, which can be, if you're doing a 4K movie, that's like a 9 terabyte drive file,
right?
Yeah. Files, image sequence. So you don't need to do that. You can just make the 250 gig JPEG sequence, and you're ready to go.
You're ready to roll. Yeah.
I mean, it's going to take you 30 hours to process it now, but still,
yeah. One of the interesting things, too, speaking of another company that crossed the DCP finish line, is Marquise Technologies. So I went over and took a look at their two main products they have. One is called Rain, which is their primary color grading app. And then they have another one called Mist, which is their sort of Onset Dailies competitor. And believe it or not, it looks a lot like Onset Dailies in terms of polish. It really is a beautiful interface that's kind of like a marquee topic for them. They have this really amazing interactive interface that they've coded. And one of the things that's wild about their software product is that they've recently started a collaboration with Pandora, which is a famous but sort of somewhat lesser known company in London that's been doing color tools for a long time. I think
Poggle?
They were originators, I believe, of Poggle. They're big into large scale, I guess, field programmable gate arrays that they use in these one rack unit boxes that allows you to do quite a bit of real time color grading at very high resolution. But one of the things that they never released, which is actually being rebooted by a partnership with Marquise Technologies, is the Pandora panels. So if you've ever been to Pandora, I think .co.uk, there is a beautiful 3D rendering of a set of panels that are really gorgeous. So they've got they did have them at the booth. And I think it's the only set in existence that actually exists. And I took a hell of a lot of pictures of them. But what it is that they are going to be taking all the technology that went into those panels and working out a new, more value engineered panel with more modern materials and encoder science. And so this will be really interesting to see what happens, because this will be another highly refined product. It's a company from Switzerland, Marquise is, and they apparently said that they have sort of they have France and a lot of sort of what I'll call, like, I guess, Northern European. They're popular in Northern European countries. And so essentially what's going on is they're trying hard to reach America, because they know that's a big market, and probably into Asia as well. But what will happen is this will be another high caliber color grading application that will have a full featured, you know, full panel. And, you know, that kind of solution doesn't come around as a new product very often. So this will be another neat option for people looking for something if they don't find what they're looking for, either in a base light or a Pablo or
just whatever. When things were clearing up.
I know, right. But you know what? I think that a lot of options makes for a really vibrant market.
For sure.
And it's definitely creating a lot of competition.
I think we have a really vibrant, just seeing the kind of development and the maturity of these products, you can say it's a pretty vibrant market.
Yeah, well.
And I think one aspect of the market that's really interesting is I'm seeing a lot of concern about calibration. We see a Resolve added GUI calibration support.
Yeah.
One of the things that you can do with that is actually make your GUI interface black and white, but that would be cool.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. That is interesting.
So you can, you know, you don't have to have clients look at it and go, I'd like it to be more like this.
Yeah.
You can just be like, no, see that color image.
Oh, wow. So
they're like, no, I want it to be black and white.
You can just have a LUT. You can just make a LUT that makes your image black and white.
That's an interesting concept. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, they're like, wait, what would it look like in black and white? Wow. Make the whole thing in black and white.
Yeah. I mean, I guess
make it look like that.
You could go like Luma, maybe. I don't know. But that's an interesting thought. Yeah. To keep the client staring at the right screen.
So do you guys think it was a real problem? Like, one thing that you noticed is you went over to look at Film Master and they're like, oh no, sorry, it's upstairs. Do you think that that's a real problem for them?
But you know what? I would like to say that I think Film Master is doing possibly better than we think. And what's going on is that I think a couple other guys went and took a look at the Film Master booth. Was a small, like, what, 10 by 10 booth with a lady handing out business cards in it. And as it turns out, at least, that lady was not all of the Film Master contingent. She was pushing people up to their Renaissance hotel booth. So it's interesting. The guys at Digital Vision decided to do a little bit more quiet, intimate atmosphere with their demos in a hotel suite. Now, there are companies that do that as a way to save cost. At the same time, it's probably a nicer environment than a show floor to take a hard look at a $100,000 grading.
It's absolutely true that the show floor is not a great place to look at a color critical evaluation.
Initially, we thought that was all that was there was that lady. And we were like, oh no, they're definitely like bolting the doors shut. But it turns out that they're at least showing their Phoenix tools, the DVO stuff. They've got a lot of stuff going on with Precision. They've got new updates to Film Master. Plus, they have a really cool option similar to, I guess, like Baselight 1, where they are doing Fuse. And they're doing the center section of a Precision panel. And so you can get that for a fairly affordable rate. I don't know what the price was, but it's a way to get into Film Master without the full cost of the large system. So they're trying too, although I think they need to do more. Right, Juan?
Yeah, I mean, I think you know, one thing is the impression you get.
Right.
Is a
lot of people didn't find out about the Renaissance Suite, I bet, and think that that was all there was the show floor.
Right, or just, you know, that extra step. Although it does kind of weed out the kind of the traffic that you get at some of the booths. I'd like it if, especially for color critical stuff, like if companies did both. So you have like, well, here's our show floor, we're kind of showing this, but if you really want to get in depth,
that's a good idea.
Come back to our room.
Right.
Pretty girl.
Yeah.
And we'll get deep. We'll take a really good look at this panel. I'll let you really play with my balls.
Whoa. we're now not safe for iTunes.
Clean tag gone.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think that's a good strategy. I've seen that with other companies doing that where they'll have the whisper booth and things like that. But I think going back to one thing, another place where you kind of want to have that critical thing is in monitor evaluation too.
Yeah.
So that's another place where it's like, you know, and some companies like Sony set up dark booths where you can kind of go and look at the monitor, and that's a slightly better way to look at it. But it, you know, in a critical, properly designed critical viewing environment would be the best way to see things.
The one thing I wanted to bring up just as a last cool thing I saw. So while I was at the Assimilate booth, the Assimilate interface is sort of the Scratch interface is a very tablet-based interface, although it works well with a mouse. One of the other things is the buttons, because of the idea of using it with a tablet, are a little larger, just to give you a good target if you're using a tablet. Some guys did a really innovative thing where they built an Assimilate Scratch, a full Scratch system, into a Range Rover. And so,
and the reason for this is,
well, what they're doing is they've got a situation where,
because we could,
it's called Radar Mobile. So if you want to check them out online, they have a really interesting situation. It reminds me a lot of the camera cars, like the high performance camera boom cars. Mm-hmm. But what they did is they built a complete
high performance grading car.
Well, what it is that they built a high performance DIT cart essentially out of a Range Rover with a full PC in the tire well, and they are using a large, I think it's like a 24-inch or 30-inch touchscreen with the Scratch interface in the back seat. It's on a swinging arm, and they've got a really nice, I think it's like an ISO monitor for viewing, possibly another one, but I took some pictures of it. But the thing that's amazing, check this out for competitive. They're offering that Range Rover equipped with Scratch and a touch panel interface and room for your director, your DIT, and, you know, possibly a good-looking tuxedoed out driver for, I believe it's around $700 or $800 a day. So they are trying to sort of throw down this really interesting new concept rather than heaving around a large DIT.
Isn't that the end of like that's how industries start to die? Like the DIT kind of competitive pricing. Well,
what I would say is that, you know, it's an interesting innovation that they've built a full fledged 4K grading system into a car.
It's the onset equivalent of like the stretch Hummer limo. I mean, it seems like it would belong.
No, that's for final grading.
It seems like this would belong more at a car show. show than at an Airbnb. Yeah. But I will say,
don't drive it around the drive.
I will say that the app that I would most associate with like a tricked out Range Rover would be Assimilate Scratch. Yeah,
exactly. Well, the funny thing is that you know, there is this concept that people are testing out of bringing post to set.
Yeah.
And so this is an interesting
we could do a whole show honestly on like where does post begin, because this is actually a legitimate issue in the industry. So let's not start that debate. Yeah, that's a whole show right there. But I want to mention one last thing that I saw that I thought was pretty cool is, and actually they were showing a short that I did was that the FSI monitors now have LUT support. So they have a couple of nice new monitors. Well,
they have some beautiful new monitors.
Yeah, they have a 32 inch that's really quite lovely,
gorgeous,
and they have a 24 inch that does like 99% of P3 space, which is great,
fantastic,
and is the same prices or similar pricing to before. The whole line has multiplexed input, so you can do like a dueling signal into a 3G.
Because each one there's a deserializer and each SDI input now giving you a dual input at a
exactly. So you and you can do side by side with it, which is insane. And they have this new color engine; they're calling it Color Fidelity Engine 2, which allows you to actually bring in a 3D LUT.
Right.
So which is nuts because that means that you can use something like now you can use Lightspace actually with any of the models, but you can use other apps to do a profile, load it in. You can also load in custom LUTs like look LUTs.
And so you get basically a transform, say for Alexa or something like that. Mm-hmm. Like
well, some of those are built in already. Right. So they've added support for the Blackmagic Cinema Camera, Canon C-Log, for Alexa
Right into the monitor.
And for now, S-Log and S-Log 2.
Yeah.
And so they've got those right. So as an onset tool, those are great.
Really, yeah.
And then you have the ability on top of that to sort of load custom LUTs. So a lot of times...
Like look LUTs, actually.
For example, you'll get... colorists sometimes get asked to sort of consult on the look before they really start shooting. They'll shoot a little test footage, play around with it, build a LUT. You can apply that LUT into the monitor, and the DB can then see the image as it's intended to look and can light and adjust accordingly,
right?
Which is really valuable. So those are really cool features, actually.
Yeah, and the thing that's really interesting is that Brahm and Chris and everyone, Johan there, they're all really listening to their customers. So just in case you bought a 2461 recently, they're going to continue to sell that monitor because a lot of their customers have 2461s and they want to continue to make that available for people that would like consistency. But they do have the new CM240. So the big difference, just
and they have a new 17 inch also.
And they have a new 17 as well. But the big difference is the 2461 will do a single LUT. And that has CFE.
A 1D LUT. And actually, all their monitors now will load 1D LUTs. And they're going to have a little app that lets you just do your own curve and load it right onto the monitor.
And transfer it in, And then the other thing is that the new monitors, so the CM 240 and I guess what, the 320, will allow you to do not only the first LUT, but also a look LUT as well.
Yeah, they support very, very large LUTs. They like big LUTs over there.
Yeah, they like big LUTs and they cannot lie. Okay. So the thing is that I think the one of the nicest things about FSI is just how much they react to customer feedback and input, and it just shows all over their whole booth, you know. So the kind of things, you know, you kind of wish for what you want at Sony, but then you actually talk to, you know, Brahm and those guys, and then at the next NAB, all of a sudden what you ask for is there. So that's really tough combination to beat. So, and then, you know, when you call and you can talk to them about pretty much any problem directly on the phone, I don't know if any company can quite hang with that. So, yeah. So, I mean, between FSI and Sony and Mystica and Autodesk and Scratch and the Resolve 10 tech preview.
We didn't even mention the cameras.
I know.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
there was a lot. And to think that this was actually kind of one of the mellower shows, I think, in recent memory.
And our 10-minute podcast got blown wide open, is now I got it.
So, we're going to continue this conversation on the show, and we'll have more to talk about. And we'll also see these things sort of develop as they go from kind of announcements to actual shipping products.
Yeah.
And we'll be talking about it for a while.
Yeah. So with that, my name is Jason Myris. You can catch me on Twitter at Jason Myris or on LiftGam again. I'll be posting a lot of NAB pics and all the details of what I saw.
And I'm Josh Pitok. You can see me at Josh Pitok on Twitter and at my website, www.joshpitok.com.
And I'm Juan Salvo. You can catch me on Twitter at J_Salvo, and I'm on LiftGam again and elsewhere. And I'm a colorist in New York City. And thank you for listening. We'll catch you guys next time.